Tony, can you hear me? Galen, can you hear me? Claire.
What?
Never mind.
Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. Thank you, Micah Cohen, for filling in last week. And thank you for also being here this week. He's sitting right there. Micah Cohen, hello.
My pleasure, Politics. Jody. I'm happy you're back.
Yes, I'm happy I'm back too. Politics editor. And, of course, alongside editor-in-chief Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Hello, Jody.
And politics writer Claire Malone, who is joining us from the ABC studio in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., in case people didn't know what our nation's capital was. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Jody.
Are you excited that it's infrastructure week again? I feel like you're the one who always brings up
I'm just all about rebuilding America's roads and bridges.
So it actually is infrastructure week, dear listeners. And I guess there's a plan emerging. But for today's show, we are not going to talk about it. We're kind of going to wait and see how infrastructure week plays out and what's actually in this Trump bill. It is something we're keen on. We may talk about it in future weeks. But for today's show, there's a few things on the docket. We're going to start with a topic that is a big theme for Republican attacks and also at the center of this conversation about the direction of the Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi, she staged an 8-hour, not exactly a filibuster, just an 8-hour super long floor speech last week in support of DACA, and she is heading into her 16th year as Democratic leader in the House. So we just kind of want to talk about what role she plays, I guess, for both parties. And also, I just want to note that, like, given how crowded our political news is these days, it's amazing that Pelosi staged this speech and, like, it just didn't, I didn't feel like people noticed. It was just like, oh, that was neat.
Can I render
the longest floor speech ever?
Can I render a hashtag unpopular opinion?
You want to do it now or you want to do it when we actually do the segment?
I mean, I'm full of unpopular opinions, so I can get one out of the way now.
Okay.
The news cycle has been fairly slow so far in 2018. I'm someone who professionally...
It's not unpopular.
Yeah.
No, it is, though.
That's a setup to the unpopular.
Because you listen to, like, I listen to a lot of podcasts. For some reason, I got in the habit now lately of, like, listening to, like, all our friends and competitors' podcasts a lot. And they all have this incentive, as we have the incentive too, to make it seem like, oh my God, the stuff that happened like this week was a really big deal. And cable news has that incentive too. I'm telling you, this feels more like the news cycles of like 2014 or something, where there's certainly things of significance happening, but where you have to like, where it's hard to kind of come up with a set list of like what we're running with on the podcast or how to program the site. Fewer emergency podcasts.
But this goes into the sort of mild observation I was just making, which was that we had a sort of historic moment, the longest speech ever possibly in the history, and
people don't really care about that.
Yeah,
though.
We sort of are so frantic and what you don't. Okay.
Well,
we're still in the intro, folks. Let me just say the one other thing we're going to talk about, and then we will talk about Pelosi, which is later after we talk about Pelosi, we're going to talk about a new study that says that the use of election forecasts in campaign coverage can confuse voters and may lower turnout. We're going to hear some more.
It's the study that's confused.
We're going to hear more hashtag unpopular opinions from Nate. We're going to hear some more opinions from Nate later about that one, I'm sure. We're also going to do a quick check-in on the gerrymandering case in Pennsylvania. But let's begin with the minority leader. As the Washington Post put it last week about the upcoming special House election in Pennsylvania, they said, quote, attack ads in Pennsylvania find a theme, that theme, Pelosi, Pelosi, and more Pelosi. So we'll talk a little bit about why she's such a target for GOP ire. But Claire, let's get back to that floor speech. I know you wanted to jump in there. What did you see as the goal for her in giving that 8-hour pro-DACA floor speech before the budget was passed, and do you think it was effective, you know, according to whatever you assess as her goals?
Well, I don't think it was super effective in the sense that, you know, she eventually went to her caucus and said, I'm going to vote against this bill because it doesn't include the kind of DACA provisions I have, but you guys can do whatever is in your hearts, which is sort of it's a little bit of a wishy-washy thing. I think the idea being she wanted to make her base happy and sort of take this stand about DACA, but also knew that people in her caucus were put in a precarious situation. But I do think, you know, it signals the importance of DACA to Democrats that she did make this 8-hour long speech. Irritatingly, many of the headlines included the fact that she wore heels. I will point out that many American women wear heels for 8 hours a day, and it is not a notable thing. But I do think the fact that she is trying to bring this to the fore, the DACA issue, it kind of is exemplifies the fact that this is a one issue right now legislatively that the Democrats are sort of trying to leverage. They know it's popular with the public. And I think Pelosi getting up and making that speech was a recognition that this is something that moves Democrats and moves Democratic voters.
I agree with that. I'd put it a little more sharply. I think she was covering for the fact that they were going to give in on DACA.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
She wasn't going to hold her members' feet to the fire to vote no on the budget compromise. And so she, you know, it's like a magician's, you know, they wave their hands around a lot so you don't look.
If you have no cattle, then you better have a lot of hats, was her philosophy.
Exactly, yeah.
But is that the role of a party leader to kind of do that? I mean, I guess I'm trying to get to the question of to give that cover in that way. And I guess to break with where the party was going, right? If the storyline of last week was Democrats went in this direction and allowed for the budget to pass, you would think that a party leader would be maybe at the forefront of that, not taking the stand that was sort of in the opposite direction. I'm just trying to get a sense of where she is positioning herself,
I think,
within the party.
One role that's evolved for the party leader is that the party leader has to be willing to kind of take everyone's arrows, right? Everyone's kind of slings and arrows and like kind of not be the popular one, right? Do thing that on the one hand, you have to do a certain amount of things that placate your base. On the other hand, you have to do a certain amount of things that involve making these compromises that your base really doesn't like. And whereas a president always tries to get out in front, I mean, you know, in their own, Trump actually is not very skilled at this, right? But Obama was sort of skilled at trying to play both sides of the fence, where if he was having a good PR week, then on any given day, you would both think that he's playing to his base and to the center. You know, Bush with compassionate conservatism. Trump every now and then has moments of this. You saw a little bit of that in the State of the Union. With the party leaders, it's more like, you know, you're taking this crap from all sides and you know you're getting the worst of both worlds. You kind of have like the mop-up job a little bit where you know, all four party. I guess Chuck Schumer is like maybe a little bit less unpopular, but still quite unpopular.
Yeah, they're all unpopular.
But they're all like super unpopular because both the base and the center distrust them. And I don't think that has to do with the particular skills of the four party leaders.
Right.
I think it's kind of like the nature of the job.
Yeah, I think she was taking one for the team. It was notable that after an 8-hour speech in favor of DACA, who were the people standing behind her applauding? Well, it wasn't sort of the young liberal Democrats in the House. It was mostly the kind of party establishment, so to speak. So I think Pelosi was just, you know, acting in her role as party leader.
You know, we started this conversation in the office, in Slack, and Julia Azari, who contributes to the site, kind of made this really interesting observation, which is that often, historically in the U.S., there's been a sort of separation between the party leaders, who are the sort of like firebrands and the public-facing folks, and then maybe the more legislator types, the vote-getters, the people who are just really good at working their colleagues and sort of wrangling up votes. And maybe lately we've seen that those are becoming one and the same, and that you kind of have to do both, and that maybe there's sometimes tension between the two. So I wonder, Claire, if we're seeing any of that with Pelosi, where maybe she's more of a natural vote wrangler and just sort of like a politician, and now she's maybe having to go out and take some of these arrows, as we just described.
Well, this is an interesting idea. So Nancy Pelosi is from a political family. Her father was the mayor of Baltimore. You know, she knows how to whip votes. She knows how to fundraise. She's a huge fundraiser for the Democratic Party. She's been, you know, in her 16 years, an incredibly effective person behind the scenes. You know, I think something like Obamacare, right, where, you know, you wanted to make sure that Democrats, some Democrats in sort of uncertain districts were voting for the, you know, big marquee legislation like that. You know, that stuff is important as a leader. I think Nancy Pelosi has an interesting place in American politics. So like Pelosi, Paul Ryan, and Mitch McConnell are probably the most visible members of Congress. And Pelosi has been turned into a really divisive figure. She's been caricatured in Republican campaign ads for years. You know, and it's those ads are often a mixture of kind of sexist caricatures and also play on the fact that she is incredibly wealthy. And, you know, you can spin that pretty easily as she's out of touch, you know, liberal, San Francisco, wealthy, out of touch Nancy Pelosi. And for a variety of reasons, sexism probably the most predominant one, that sort of spun into making Nancy Pelosi a really divisive figure. I think, you know, she's also become a figure of resentment among younger Democrats. And I don't necessarily think it's sexism. People often say, you know, people want to push Nancy Pelosi out of her job. I think there's legitimate reasons for her to stay as leader. And I also think there are very legitimate reasons for younger Democrats to want to replace not just Pelosi, but a lot of the leadership, because they are much older. There's been a lot of talk in, you know, the past year or two about rebuilding a Democratic bench. And some of that also comes with, you know, making sure that younger people are learning how to do this leadership. So she is an interesting figure that is, she's a less charismatic public figure. Not that I'm saying Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan are particularly charismatic, although Ryan did have a period of sort of a honeymoon period with the DC press back in the day. I encourage readers to Google his workout photo shoot.
He's got a great backwards red hat in that, if memory serves.
He did.
I agree with that, but let me stipulate a few things. One is, yes, Pelosi is a polarizing figure. NBC News, Wall Street Journal for a while has asked people to rate her from like very positive, somewhat positive, neutral, somewhat negative, very negative. About a quarter to a third of people consistently since the 2008 campaign or so rate her very negative, as opposed to really like a handful of people, less than 10%, say very positive. Mm-hmm. So she's really polarizing, but it's asymmetric, right? There's a big chunk of people, mostly Republicans, I'd imagine, who really hate her. There's not that many people, as Claire was hinting at, that are like huge Pelosi fans, mm-hmm. right? Most of the value she brings to the Democratic Party is, as Julia was suggesting, behind the scenes. It's in vote counting. It's in, you know, massaging the caucus, right? A couple things. One, let's not like overlook the value of that. Like, I shudder to think what the coverage would be of Pelosi if she had f***ed up in the way that like Mitch McConnell did during healthcare, right? You have all these stories about, oh, is Pelosi done? Is it time to move on? McConnell like brought bills to the floor that then failed. And like, he has failed in a bunch of ways by which we traditionally measure the leader of a party. And yet, I mean, there's been a few McConnell takes, but like to a much lesser extent.
That's a really good point.
The other thing is just like the extent to which the media harps about Pelosi and the extent to which she has become a boogeyman for the right is because she's a woman. Like, it's just not complicated. Every congressional leader is unpopular. Schumer is unpopular. McConnell's unpopular. Boehner was unpopular when he was there. Look at Paul Ryan, who was pretty popular, actually, until the second he becomes House Speaker, right? Then he becomes unpopular. Why are they all unpopular? Well, Congress is super unpopular. So, of course, you know, the leader of Congress is going to be unpopular. You know, the media makes excuses for it, like, well, she's rich and from, as Claire was saying, she's rich and from a liberal city on the coast. Well, she's the leader of the Democratic Party. Is it that crazy that the leader would be from a city, be liberal, and from the coast? That's where most of the party is. So,
but there's a premise to your point that I just want to harp on a little bit, which is, do you really feel like she is more of a boogeyman or maybe forget the right, actually, the media you mentioned, you know, that she gets more kind of attention as a force than other leaders? Or are we just living in an incredibly polarized time and anyone who's the leader of a party is going to get a lot of, I mean, we talk a lot about Paul Ryan, we talk a lot about Mitch McConnell, we talk a lot about all the insurgencies that might happen in the GOP in Congress, like, don't we?
There are more Super PAC ads that feature Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
So, you know, there's Super PAC ads about Nancy Pelosi in the Georgia 6 race. There are ones that were popping up in this Pennsylvania special election. I mean, Micah does put a blunter, made a blunter way of saying this, which is like, yeah, like it's more easy to caricature a woman of either party. And it happens with Republican women too, Democratic women. You know, we ask these women to, you know, look a certain sort of decorous way, but also we want them to be attractive. You know, you see someone like Carly Fiorina who during the primaries, I mean, Trump made fun of the way she looked. You know, he talked about, you know, people will talk about women's plastic surgery, whatever. So Nancy Pelosi certainly has those weights to carry. I'll also just point out here, this is, I mean, neither here nor there, but there's sort of this classic political science that talks about how women are more likely to succeed in parliamentary systems. So, you know, a member, an MP is more likely to become prime minister. A woman MP is more likely to become prime minister in part because they can thrive more in these sort of, you know, behind the scenes wheeling dealing and be rewarded for it by their party members. Whereas in a system like ours that does involve this campaigning in order to become president, you saw it with Clinton, and you know, there's a bit more of this media focus. And so I think mm-hmm. Nancy Pelosi has a bit of that problem.
I think Nancy Pelosi has been unfairly kind of vilified and made into this kind of, like, you know, just this figure that's hated on the right and that Democrats are ambivalent about. I think all that has been unfair and reflects kind of injustice in our system. But that injustice is there and the system is what it is. And so I simultaneously think Democrats would probably be better off if they had a different minority leader.
Yeah, I mean, it's and very savvily, Nancy Pelosi's team, you know, says this is all sexist or ageist, which is fair. You can make that argument. But it's also, as I said earlier today, as I said earlier, you know, people are allowed to think, like, look, the leadership is too old. We need to get some of these new people in. This is, like, heavily baby boomer and above in the Democratic Party leadership. Let's get some young blood in there.
Y'all reached a consensus on this without providing that much evidence of it.
Consensus on what is this?
On the extent to which Pelosi's problems have to do with sexism.
Okay.
I mean, all these congressional leaders are pretty unpopular. I think there are certainly tropes that the media engages in with respect to Pelosi that it might not with the other three.
Mm-hmm.
But Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan are equally, I think, maybe actually a little bit more unpopular if you look at polling there. I mean, you know, Schumer is newer and therefore a bit less unpopular, though still unpopular. So I'm not sure that she necessarily stands out. I mean, I don't think any of the four of them are in the mold where they're meant to, like, appeal to, like, a broad constituency of swing voters necessarily.
Right, but there's more coverage of her.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of the coverage. I'm with Nate. This is what I was trying to get at a little bit earlier with you, Micah. I mean, I need to be a slightly more convinced that there's an overwhelming narrative about Pelosi that doesn't kind of exist for other, you know, polarizing leaders.
They might all have similar approval ratings or disapproval ratings, but I think she is used a lot more in PAC ads and in races that she is not in, right? Like, she's mm-hmm. she just has become a stand-in for, like, limousine liberal.
Nate?
Okay, so I'm not a big fan of Rasmussen reports, but they're, I think, the most recent polling firm to survey all four party leaders. Mm-hmm. So Schumer is a -7, Pelosi's a -18, Ryan's a -28, and McConnell's a -34.
Yeah, but Nate, the argument isn't that she's unpopular because of sexism. She's unpopular because she's a congressional leader and Congress is super unpopular. The argument is that the media and political operatives talk about and put a lot of weight on that unpopularity because she's a woman.
You know why? Because you don't have a Democratic president right now. And the previous Democratic president was also used in a demonizing way.
Don't they talk about Schumer as much as they talk about Pelosi?
And did Pelosi demonization?
They probably will. But Pelosi has been around a lot longer.
Yeah, but it started in 2008.
I think you're being a bit obtuse about this. Like, I don't have it in front of me, but I bet if you looked on, you know, TV news or whatever for the number of mentions of Pelosi during these ads, she just comes up more. And Schumer and McConnell and Ryan are not presented as this easy, you see her face in a certain patina in the TV commercial, and you know, ooh, the big bad boogeyman Pelosi, right? Like, boogeywoman, I guess.
I'm just saying, I want you to disprove my null hypothesis, right? And I'm articulating a null hypothesis that I think has been overlooked, which is to say that she is no more unpopular, in fact, less unpopular than the two Republican men. You know, she's more unpopular than Schumer, but she's been around as a party leader a lot longer than Schumer. And believe me, there are lots of things that will be demonized about Schumer and are already starting to be to some extent, right? So the null hypothesis being like, hey, look, this is what happens when someone is a party leader, in her case, since 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yes, she's used a lot, but that, like, if she were a guy, that the same thing would happen. I mean, I think it's hard to disprove. And maybe we can exist in a world where, like, the default should be, look, I think the media is sexist in how it portrays Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton and Kirsten Gillibrand and lots of people, right? I think the Republican Party and sometimes even Democrats have been willing to play upon that sexism as a campaign strategy. But I'm not sure that Pelosi is a huge, like, outlier.
Yeah, I think you're recasting what Mike and I are saying, though, in what you want it to be. You're right. I don't know. I'm not disagreeing with you that she's any more unpopular than any of these other leaders. I'm just saying she is brought in more than any of these other guys as a figure of this is the divisive figure. She has become the personification, you know, in a lot of TV ads and coverage. That's what we're saying. It's more qualitative, I guess, than quantitative.
Right. Okay. So let me advance this though a little bit. So putting aside exactly if we can determine sort of why she's being used the way she is and whether that's different from others, going into the fall, I think we can all agree that Nancy Pelosi, in terms of GOP messaging, is going to serve some sort of boogeyman role, right? Nate, is that an effective argument by Republicans? Is she a useful, foil for the GOP?
Sure. Look, Republicans basically have two strategies to try and mitigate their losses at the midterms, one of which is to point to the economy, which is going the stock market aside pretty well, and the other of which is to gin up the base in various ways, and like Nancy Pelosi is an effective way to gin up the base, I think. And maybe with swing voters to say, hey, look, she's a San Francisco liberal and therefore, you know, she is not the way the Democrats are going to move to the center. So, yeah, they're going to do a certain amount of that. I mean, by the way, even though I think that, like, probably any party leader this number of years in would be somewhere in the vicinity of how much she's demonized, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more likely less than more. But that doesn't mean that you wouldn't benefit if you're Democrats from switching things up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The way I analogize it is to, like, an NFL team or a soccer team that fires its head coach every 2 or 3 years.
Both football teams.
Both football. Yeah. Football or football.
Mm-hmm.
Either way.
What accent was that?
That was everywhere but the U.S.
Football.
Go ahead. Firing your coach every 2 years just to mix it up. That's a good strategy, right?
Well, there's
it's going great for Cleveland.
First of all, there's an equilibrium there because, first of all, you don't know whether the coach is good or bad, right? But the heuristic that, like, when things are going badly for our organization, go ahead and fire the coach because why not? It probably is more likely to help than to hurt. And second of all, even though it is kind of BS, you create at least a temporary boost of excitement and freshness and change the narrative around the team. You know, Pelosi has been Democratic Party leader for 15 years. Of that time, only four, it'll be 16 at the end of this year, 16, only four were spent in the majority. You know, in a very narrow and perhaps unfair way, you can say that's not a very good track record. They got a health care bill passed. They did very well, obviously, in 2008, but then they lost a record number of seats the next year, and they haven't taken back the House or come particularly close since. This year might be close.
So,
But, like, you can just say, like, look, she has not performed that well from a wins and losses standpoint. Hasn't been terrible. I mean, they've gotten some things passed, and she's very influential and, like, you know, certainly very capable. But, like, 16 years is a long time for any person to hold any position of power, and maybe it's time to move on.
So, Micah, to that end, I mean, does this fall's elections serve as a referendum in any way? How Democrats do on Pelosi, and I guess in turn, you know, potentially seal her fate as future of a leader of the party.
I mean, it probably will. It shouldn't.
Why not?
It goes back to that public role behind the scenes mm-hmm. role dichotomy. The Speaker of the House or the minority leader is really in a really important position, a really powerful position. That importance and that power is largely confined to Congress and the legislative process and that kind of shit.
There's a big fundraising role too, though, right?
And sure, fundraising.
And that gets spread around the country.
The idea that the 2010 midterm, Democratic midterm losses or the 2014 losses can be pinned on Pelosi to any great degree, I think, is silly. Or the idea that Pelosi plays any magnified role in the American public's conception of party politics, I just don't buy. I think, you know, those years it was Obama's party, and much larger forces dictated who won and lost seats that year. So do I think 2018 will be a referendum on Pelosi? And if Democrats don't take the House, I think there's a really good chance she's out.
Yeah.
Even if they do take the House, there's a chance she could kind of step down, you know, with a confetti parade. But I don't think it should, no.
Mm-hmm. Claire, let me ask you one question, and then we'll move on, which is, I guess, sort of the flip side of this. Do we at all see Democrats going into the fall turning McConnell and Ryan into foils in this way, or is it really just all Trump, Trump, Trump?
I think both. All of the above.
Mm-hmm.
Villainize as many congressional leaders as you can. I mean, I'm sure there'll be a lot of sound bites they'll pull from the healthcare debacle on the GOP side. I think all of them are, you know, McConnell, Ryan, and Trump are obviously all very visible figures in American politics who, if you're a Democratic voter, you probably resent. So, yes, I think it'll be attack ad central.
But yeah, it's actually a good illustration of why I think gender does play such a big role here. Because imagine you're a Democratic voter, and you're like, I don't know if I'm going to turn out this year. I don't love Trump, but I don't know. He hasn't ruined my bank account. And then you see an ad, and it's like, if John Doe gets into Congress, his first vote is going to be for Mitch McConnell. And then you're like, oh, I got to get out to the polls. You know, that's just hard to imagine, as opposed to we've seen countless ads like that with Nancy Pelosi. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. We're going to leave it there. We will continue to talk about all of these issues, obviously, going forward. But for now, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about a new study which criticizes the role of election forecasting in elections and its effect on voters. First, though, a quick word from this week's sponsors. This week's podcast is brought to you by Blue Bottle Coffee. Nothing complements a crisp winter morning quite like a cup of coffee, or actually here in New York, it's going to be about 55, 60 degrees all week. So nothing complements a mild winter morning like a cup of coffee, but not just any coffee. You need delicious, flavorful coffee that will change the way you look at your morning cup of coffee. Blue Bottle Coffee provides the most delicious coffee in the world right to your door. Your Blue Bottle Coffee is roasted and shipped to your home within 48 hours of placing your order, so the beans arrive at peak freshness. One sip of Blue Bottle Coffee will make you realize that you've been drinking subpar coffee your entire life. That's okay to have those moments where you realize your entire life has been wasted. You'll move on. They search the planet far and wide to secure exclusive relationships with independent growers all over the world to find only the most delicious and sustainable coffee there is. If you're worried about flavor, don't worry. You can take Blue Bottle's Coffee Match Quiz online to find the perfect cup just for you. From blends to espresso to single origins, Blue Bottle Coffee has it all. Hurry to bluebottlecoffee.com/politics for $10 off your first coffee subscription order. That's bluebottlecoffee.com/politics. One more time, bluebottlecoffee.com/politics. This week's podcast is also brought to you by SimpliSafe. Yes, security systems deter burglars, but there is still a burglary every 8 seconds in America. Why is that? Well, think about it. Burglars don't just give up because some houses have security systems. No, they find a house that isn't protected. That's why securing your home is important, and that's where SimpliSafe comes in. SimpliSafe is incredibly smart, and its sensors will protect every point of access to your home. Plus, if a burglar so much as tries to break in, an ear-shattering siren will let them know that the police are already on their way. Best of all, SimpliSafe's 24/7 monitoring is just $14.99 a month, and they'll never lock you into a long-term contract. With SimpliSafe, you even get a 60-day money-back guarantee, so there's no reason not to try it today. Get SimpliSafe by going to simplisafe.com/politics. That's simply with an I, S-I-M-P-L-I, safe.com/politics. Go now, save an extra 10%, simplisafe.com/politics. Okay, back to the show. All right, we're back. Let's talk about this new study that gets at something that is near and dear to our hearts, and I have a hunch will be near and dear to our to our ire in a minute. Probabilistic forecasting and the effect of that kind of forecasting on voters. Before we get to the specifics of the finding, though, Nate, if I can, ask you a broader question. Is it a valuable line of inquiry, whether it's in a study or in, say, a podcast conversation, to ask questions about the effect of polling and forecasting, some of which we do here at 538, on actual voter behavior? That's like a legit sort of territory to explore, do you think?
It is. I wish it were done in a way where the data in the study didn't blatantly contradict the headline.
Uh-huh.
But it's certainly a valid line of inquiry. I mean, we'll get into discussion later on, I think, about, like, is it an unalloyed good if turnout is higher? Oh, and if a forecast provides better information, and as a result of that, people choose to spend more time playing with their kid, or going out to dinner, or
we need to
cutting the lawn.
First.
You can bring your kid into the voting booth, and you get that adorable picture, too, though, I'm just saying. Okay, so I think that's actually right, and I think that's like the bigger, more interesting conversation this sets up. But let me set up this actual study conducted by Sean Westwood of Dartmouth. Oh, gosh, I should have learned how to pronounce this beforehand. Yiptak Lelkis of the University of Pennsylvania and Solomon Messing of the Pew Research Center. The main takeaway seems to be this. I'm reading it from a Pew summary of this study, and I quote, "The study finds that probabilistic numbers can leave people with the impression that a race is far less competitive than when they see polling data presented as the percentage of the vote they are expected to get, something that the people in this study argue is more familiar to the public." So there's a lot to tease out there. Nate, let's start with that first assertion that a probabilistic forecast, which is basically so-and-so has X percentage chance of winning, is hard for people to understand. Do you agree with that?
Their study actually shows that probabilistic forecasts yield a more accurate understanding, literally the opposite of what they say, that literally people have a more accurate understanding of the competitiveness of a race when presented with a 538-style forecast than not. That's literally what their data says.
So walk us through that.
Yeah.
So they present an example where, and it's like the main example in the study, where they have a race where they present information in two ways. Mm-hmm. One of which is to say that one candidate is ahead 55 to 45, and that the margin of error on that candidate's vote share is plus or minus 2. The other way is to say this candidate has an 87% chance of winning without listing the vote share. And there's a third way where they list both pieces of information. And these are supposed to be equivalent. I'm not sure how they decide that 87% and 55-45 are equivalent. It's a little weird.
I was confused by that, yeah.
But leaving that aside for a moment, right? When you present people with only the candidate being ahead by 10 points or having 55% of the vote share, plus or minus 2%, people only translate that into a 60% chance of winning, which doesn't make any sense at all. So it shows that if you just present these numbers, even with the margin of error, so if you present 55% plus or minus 2, and that's a margin of error, then it should be 95% or like 99% or something if you're interpreting that forecast literally. So it shows that, first of all, that if you present only the vote share without probabilistic information, people's inferences are really, really far off. That this race that's quite lopsided, they take as being only 60% likely. If you present the 87% chance, then interestingly enough, people are still more conservative than they quote-unquote should be and only give the candidate a 70% chance of winning. Mm-hmm. So not only are people not overconfident, they're underconfident, although if you give them the probability, they're closer to the right number.
So I think that's really interesting, you know, look at this, and I agree that there's some fishiness there, but the way I read this study, and it's a sort of fine line, but as they were trying to make a distinction between whether these forecasts land on people understanding a sort of vote share, but then the next level, and I think this is their main argument, is that it has to do with confidence. And their argument is that when someone sees a probabilistic forecast, they are more confident that the person who is ahead will win.
But kind they're of still put aside, less confident than they should be. They're still quite underconfident.
But to get to the nut of what they're saying is, do we feel like a probabilistic forecast has some larger air of because it presents itself as sort of having done some work before it shows you the number, so a larger air of whoever's ahead here, put aside the spread, whoever's ahead here
right.
is likely
this
to win.
This study is a great test of that, and it mm-hmm. shows that people are still less confident than they should be, even when they see a probabilistic forecast, and that they have no idea whatsoever what to do with non-probabilistic forecasts, and that they default toward thinking things are competitive. However, the other big problem with this study, it doesn't account for the fact that, like, you're not just going to see number 55-45. What do you think? Right? You're going to see a narrative wrapped around it, and you're going to see the New York Times or the Washington Post or 538 or whoever else, right? Like, you know, candidate A is way ahead, 55-45. Ignore the margin of error, although 55-45 actually is a pretty big lead, unlike the lead like Clinton had, for example, in November 16. But there's a narrative around it that would almost always imply, well, it depends. I mean, it depends. In 2012, people were hedging a lot more on Romney, but would very often imply a very strong lead for the candidate in charge, mm-hmm. and might yield much more confidence. Maybe you just kind of present someone, hey, 55-45, plus or minus two. I mean, no one knows what to do with that. At least the probability has like a more straightforward interpretation, and we would argue a better interpretation than you might get from a subjective headline. And we know, thanks to the study, that it doesn't make people overconfident. It actually moves them close to the right answer, but they still err toward thinking there's significantly more uncertainty than there is if you take the forecast at face value.
I found the study interesting, although I take Nate's problems with it seriously. I searched around for who had tweeted about it on Twitter, and Drew Linzer of Civics Analytics, he's like a statistician, tweeted, if people have a hard time interpreting election forecasts expressed as probabilities, then maybe election forecasts shouldn't be expressed as probabilities. For example, an election forecast could be a range of vote shares that are consistent with the polling data. Wider ranges convey more uncertainty about the outcome. Nate, but what do you think about
what this study shows is that actually really confuses people.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, that, you know, so one of the big headlines here is if you tell people it's 55-45 and the margin of error mm-hmm. is only plus or minus 2%, mm-hmm. people have no idea what that means. They're really, really far off from either the empirically accurate or the theoretically accurate probability that derives from that case.
So there are a few separate questions here. All right. Question number one. Do people have trouble correctly interpreting probabilities? Absolutely. We've known that for a while. Studies have shown that. We have talked about and we have done a lot of thinking about how best to communicate our read of an election, right? And we try to do that in a lot of different ways, one of which is a probability. In upcoming elections, I'm sure we'll experiment with additional ways to do it, right? Nate, we've talked about sometimes doing it as odds, for example, right?
One thing this too convinced me of is that if you say 55-45, people can confuse that as either being vote share or probability. So I think what we're probably going to do is to say vote share is for vote share, and we'll express everything else as Trump has a 2-in-7 chance of winning or whatever it is. Mm-hmm.
The other thing, though, is, okay, so if you're worried that people are misinterpreting probabilities, the answer isn't therefore to get rid of the probabilities. Like the weird implicit, I don't think they actually make this argument, but the sort of implicit in the study's findings and in and more explicitly in the conversation around this study is that like these probabilities, these forecasts lower turnout and are therefore bad, right? As if sort of, you know, if the race is a blowout, the race is a blowout. It's a journalist's job to clearly and correctly communicate what's going on in the world. You're not supposed to worry about how that then affects, you know, the race, for example.
But there
right?
is a place to think about the role of any journalism in crafting a sort of public conversation, and then I guess our type of journalism as well. I mean,
but our type of journalism is to try to give people the clearest picture about what's going on without like a BS narrative spin. I mean, that's like.
But should we never
part of what we're doing? And it should be the job of political parties to turn their voters out, and it should be our job to tell people what is the clear picture, the truth.
Right. So I guess that's one of the larger questions here, and I don't have a bias in either direction necessarily, but like, do we really as a 538, as journalists in general, not even need to sort of take that step to think about like what is the effect of this thing I'm putting out into the world, in our case a model, going to be on an actual voter who may or may not go to the polls?
I mean, if you have a crappy model, I mean, it's the same reason why if you're doing crappy analysis in the Times or the Post or on NBC News about the election, that misconstrues the election in either direction, there are real consequences to that. Mm-hmm. You know, in some slightly convoluted sense, one could say that, like, crappy analysis of the 2016 election maybe was responsible for some of the result, right? But our goal and any journalist's goal ought to be accuracy.
That's the first question.
Yeah, the only thing they find is that, like, when people are more confident about the outcome, they're less likely to vote. That's not a novel finding. If you go and look at turnout in different races based on how close the race is or is perceived to be, that's a trivial finding that's been known about for a long time. And it's not my place to tell people, you know, let's say an election really is 90-10, right? First of all, I'd probably still vote in that because 10% is not that uncertain. But second of all, it's not my business to tell people how they should be spending their time.
Yeah, the first question we have, so your question is, you know, should we think about what effect this has? Absolutely, sure. But that's a secondary question to, are we communicating accurately what we see in the world? Let me just give you one counterexample, which is, you know, the reason these studies find that probability forecast decreased turnout is because, according to the example used in the study, the probability more accurately communicates the state of the race. The state of the race they present is not a competitive one, and therefore turnout drops, right? As Nate just said, more competitive races have increased turnout. The other thing is, like, this cuts the opposite way too. For example, in 2016, non-probability descriptions of where the race stood, you know, just the general narrative was that Clinton had this thing locked up. We, in our writing and in our probability forecast, said, no, it's not locked up. You know, Trump has a real shot here. So the idea that, like, the idea that probability forecasts are uniquely and solely capable of adversely affecting turnout, lowering turnout, is silly. What they actually mean is, anything that says to a voter, this race is not competitive, will decrease turnout. And anything is anything. That could be, you know, freaking, I don't know, Peggy Noonan on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. Like, you know,
right.
Anyway.
So let me wrap up on one last thing that I'll ask of Micah, and then Claire, Nate, you guys can jump in, and then we'll start to move on. But I just want to come back to something you said, which is, our thinking going into this election. We're building a model. We are learning lessons from 2016, both about how we built our model and did our journalism, but also about how people interpreted it. So you want to talk a little bit more about how some of these swirling issues are affecting, you know, we're not just digging our heels in and saying we're going to do the exact same thing, right?
So let me make that clear. It's like, I get exasperated a little bit with this stuff, but, like, by no means do we feel like we're beyond reproach, and we talk and think about a lot. It's like, how can we communicate this stuff better? There's a lot of sort of misunderstanding. You know, people aren't good at interpreting probabilities. You know, anything kind of north of, I don't know, 80% is considered 100%. So we.
But this says no. This says actually not. That people think that's actually like 70%.
80%?
Yeah. They think 87% is 70%.
Right.
And so that kind of goes against that conventional wisdom.
But there's other studies that show that.
Right.
So no, there aren't.
But
people,
Nate's digging in.
Here's what I think is the problem, is that, you know, who's actually really bad at interpreting probabilities is kind of the expert community, including the media. You know, this paper, can I be frank, is pretty illiterate about what probabilities mean. I don't know if it's past peer review yet or not, but the fact that, like, oh my gosh, people are actually getting more accurate here. I mean, they kind of mentioned that in the paper, but this is kind of ignorant about, like, about kind of what the goal of a probabilistic forecast is. And it's put together by someone at Pew Research, which we very much like, and, like, two Ivy League institutions. And so, you know, I think a big part of the issue is that experts, when they intermediate information that says 70-30, will contextualize it in the wrong way. Because if you had asked the media what are Clinton's chances, I think they'd been 90-10 or something, right?
Yeah.
So let me bring this back to some of our thinking, putting this study aside, though obviously this study is informing our thinking. But just finish that thought, and then Claire, I know you want to jump in on this too.
So we have a lot of tools to try to communicate where we think any particular race stands, right? We have, graphics, visualizations. We have words, you know, we have this podcast. And we are always sort of experimenting and refining with how we do that. So I think, for example, as we were saying, I think next time we'll maybe express the overall probability as odds rather than, you know, as a number, which I think people find more intuitive. You know, at other times we've kind of played around with sports analogies, right? Other people have done that too, which people find a little more intuitive.
I think sometimes people are using the public's purported misunderstanding of probability to ask cover and to go back to a world where what the forecast says is ambiguous and therefore you don't have responsibility for how it's interpreted after the fact.
But people do misinterpret the forecast. Like,
well,
can I say something?
Yeah. This study did talk, or the write-up of the study did talk about the way television news programs, particularly ones with a liberal bent, talked a lot about these probability, these forecast models. And the implication here was that television news isn't correctly contextualizing these things for viewers. And I do agree that that's a problem. So we have this podcast, we have our website as a forum, but, you know, a lot of people get their political news from TV and, you know, well, there's no 538 TV, right? Like, we're not out there, you know, spreading we're not out there spreading the word, the good word about how to correctly interpret this. And, like, you know, I don't know, TV executives, maybe we should be on there. But, like, there is a sense that it's you know, we think about it and talk about it and, you know, we'll present it differently and, you know, in the future. But it is also this interesting quandary of how do you, in your, you know, daily update about where the two candidates stand, how do you explain to your television viewers or whatever these concepts, you know? It's so if you don't have the great, I don't know, I think that's an interesting thing of, so it's not just the people who make the models, but it's also the rest of the news media about, like, thinking about how they give their viewers as much information about how to interpret the models as possible.
No, it's a real, I totally agree with that. It's a real problem. And it's something that, like, even if you take weeks and weeks and years of your life and think about, is challenging. If you don't think about it at all and just reflexively kind of describe a forecast, you know, you do a really shitty job. I was listening to some NPR show, like 1A, and they had this, frankly, really terrible discussion about polls. And the host was like, literally within five sentences, said both, well, 538 gave Hillary Clinton a 80% chance of winning. That wasn't her odds on Election Day, but put a pin in that for a second. And then a few sentences later said, well, how come places like 538 said there was no chance that Trump could win? And it's like, well, wait a second. You know, anyway, so if, like, look, I love NPR, but if places like that are doing a really shitty job of communicating how this stuff works,
even after the fact, I mean, they do a really awful job.
A freaking year later, you know, what hope is there for, like, anyway, I don't want to hurt, you know.
Guys, the brand is strong, though. You got to say that. When people are talking about this, they're like, why did 538 do that?
We get pegged with everyone else's forecast. Why did 538 give them 99%?
Okay, we have to wrap here. I have a feeling this is not
but
going
anyway,
to be
this,
a...
okay, go ahead. This paper, if you're peer reviewing this paper, don't approve for publication.
We should give these guys a chance, a place to respond.
If y'all want to come on the show, come on the show.
Maybe not on the show. Maybe
on
the website.
No,
that's not a good invitation.
Okay. We're going to move on. And come
to the echo chamber, chamber, whatever it is.
Listeners, you maybe got a little bit of a glimpse of, we are not sure about whether we're going to bring Model Talk back or not, but a little bit of a glimpse of some of that.
This is not us nitpicking. This is fundamentally the evidence in the paper contradicts the headline. Fundamentally and
well,
profoundly.
That's the headline too. I mean, these guys didn't write.
Okay, we're gonna
in academic papers you write your own headline.
Wait a second. We at 538 are very interested in finding better ways to communicate what we're saying, and however many faults Nate sees in this paper, we apply that same level of scrutiny internally.
I think that's true. As a somewhat external observer of the internal dynamic here,
we have a lot of extreme, but sometimes the problem isn't us. Sometimes it's you.
Yeah.
And sometimes we are not hubristic, but we are defensive.
Sometimes it's us.
Sometimes it's us. Sometimes it's not us.
We also have a bit of a problem wrapping up segments here at 5:30, but that's what we're going to do right now. And rest assured, listeners, whether you like it or not, we're going to continue to have these kinds of conversations. But let's do one last thing for this week's show. Very quickly, let's have a chat about gerrymandering, because of course we just finished this long podcast series and this big project online, and as perhaps you heard, there is some gerrymandering news coming out of Pennsylvania. So here for a few minutes is our redistricting gerrymandering guru, Galen Druk, producer of this podcast, fresh off of a nice long vacation. Galen, welcome back.
Thank you. How's it going?
Let me get this straight. You drop the 6-part redistricting series, you take off out of the country, leaving chaos behind you as the courts in Pennsylvania get upended. Are you taking credit for
that was the entire plan. Yeah, I mean, I'm just here for the good parts. Everyone else can clean up the mess.
So what is the news out of this Pennsylvania story as you see it?
The Pennsylvania State Supreme Court ruled that the congressional maps in Pennsylvania violated the state constitution throughout the maps and had the legislature redraw them. The legislature is controlled by Republicans. The maps should then be approved by the Democratic governor and then ultimately approved by the court. I think the most important thing for people to understand here is, contrary to a lot of the cases that people hear about in the news about gerrymandering, this is not a federal case. This is a violation of state law. So this has nothing to do with, you know, the big Wisconsin case, the Whitford case that a lot of attention has been paid to. This is an example of how states can write their own laws that can make gerrymandering illegal if they want to.
Because this was found to have violated the state constitution,
correct,
right?
Yeah.
Exactly. And it didn't even violate a newly written law pertaining to gerrymandering. It violated a law that's been on the books for years.
And there was a deadline last Friday, maybe, to redraw the maps. And then I think some of them leaked or whatever. But you don't have to get into the nitty-gritty. But is your sense that Pennsylvania has been now, because of this, is this an effective law? Is this forcing them to move towards kind of fairer, however we interpret that word, districting?
It's not going to change it that much, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if the current iteration of the maps are going to be approved by the governor, first of all, and then ultimately approved by the courts. But what we're actually seeing is what will happen nationally if the Wisconsin Democrats win in the Whitford case.
The Supreme Court case.
Right, exactly. And what that is basically the party in control trying to find that like borderline of the furthest they can go to advantage themselves without crossing into the threshold of what is illegal, right? Because there's no definition of what is fair in redistricting that is defined by the grace of God. So the maps that they produced this time essentially give them the exact same advantage. They're just more compact and split up fewer counties or whatever. And those are part of the criteria in the Pennsylvania Constitution. So is it enough? I mean, I have a feeling that the governor wouldn't, who's a Democrat, would not approve these maps. I don't know what a court would say in this case.
But it's a perfect example of where they had to go back and follow like county lines. But Pennsylvania is so sorted politically. You know, almost all the state's Democratic voters are clustered in Philly and Pittsburgh. That even if you follow county,
world champion Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh.
Well, the western half of the state, uh-huh. Screw them. The eastern half has won a world championship. But anyway, the state is so sorted politically that Republicans went back, the legislature went back, redrew following the county lines, and you end up with the
it's
same
like
thing.
One representative may swing. You know?
Right. Have you ever heard of the Pittsburgh Freaking Penguins?
Are they the current world champions?
Back-to-back Stanley Cup champions.
Gosh. Wait, are you talking about hockey?
Yeah.
I'm talking about real sports.
I don't know. I don't know anything about hockey. Sports. But what I can say is, yes, self-sorting is a real thing in Pennsylvania. They did a similar thing to what they did in Wisconsin, where Joey Chen, who is a researcher at the University of Michigan, went in and created like 500 random maps of Pennsylvania. And none of his randomly drawn maps give Republicans as much of an advantage as they had in the first round or in the second round. So you can imagine that there is still some purposeful gerrymandering going on.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
It's something like, you know, the way that the maps are currently drawn, as well as the second iteration, gives Republicans 13 out of the 18 seats. The most that they got in the randomly drawn, you know, algorithmically drawn maps were 10 seats. Mm-hmm. So
you can't chalk up everything to self-sorting. But I mean, yes, somebody who's savvy about Pennsylvania politics could probably draw a very successful political gerrymander without even looking at partisan data.
Exactly.
Right.
So look, in our maps, and when we gerrymander seats, then we are, number one, respecting the Voting Rights Act. And so you keep...
You're saying when we, as 538, as part of our redistricting,
project. Yes. Right. And number two, we are trying to not quite go to a ridiculous extreme where you have, like, spaghetti string districts, but where, like, things are quite gerrymandered, but, like, not totally ridiculous, like, kind of politically feasible. Our Democratic gerrymander is still 9-9. In fact, Democrats would do things probabilistically here. 8.7, Republicans 9.3.
I have no idea what that means. I don't understand probabilistic. God.
Doesn't that mean it was certain?
Go ahead.
8.7-9. So basically, even with the Democratic gerrymander, it's 50-50 just because you have this problem of extreme concentration of Democrats in Philadelphia. And if you're keeping that together out of reasons of either geographic contiguity or because of majority-minority requirements, then that's really where it's a big sink for the Democratic vote.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, part of it's Democrats' fault in the sense that, like, the outlying areas of Pennsylvania used to be pretty competitive. Now they've become pretty red. So, you know, that's a problem for Democrats, irrespective of gerrymandering. But the fact is that out of all states, having any kind of community or geographic preference in your districting tends to shift things toward the GOP in Pennsylvania.
Right. I mean, we should be very clear that courts mandating that maps be more fair does not equal proportional representation.
Right.
That should never be the expectation, because there are a lot of factors at play, like geography, that will prevent that from happening.
So I have a number of questions that follow up from that, and just kind of what the role of the courts is going to be, especially when compared to the role of, say, voters and census makers and all that stuff over the coming few years. But we are going to create a space for me to ask that question and for you, dear listener, to ask those kinds of questions. So here's the plan. The last episode of the Redistricting Project podcast that Galen did, he did take some listener questions, but obviously there is ongoing news like this Pennsylvania case. So if there's anything that you have questions about regarding redistricting, big or small, from what you're seeing in the news or anything that didn't get touched on in the series, we're going to create a space for us to answer those on this podcast. We'll either carve out space as a segment in a future episode, or maybe we'll do a special episode on in this feed. Email us podcasts@538.com with your questions for Galen and our team, or you can tweet at him @GalenDruck. No question too basic or too complicated. Email podcasts@538.com or tweet @GalenDruck, and we'll see if we can't keep this important conversation going. And that's a wrap. So thank you to Galen.
Thank you.
Galen, the gerrymander.
We can come up with a better.
Galen.
What is it? Cracking and...
Yeah, that's good.
Galen the Kraken Pack.
Kraken Pack Druk.
Galen Kraken Pack
Druk. That's good.
Oh, good. Nate Silver, Editor-in-Chief, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Micah Cohen, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Claire Malone, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Claire.
Say hi to DC.
Yeah.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Our politics editor is Micah Cohen. You guys were on the show. You shouldn't get the double up like
this. No, we still
get
it. Get it. Galen and I.
You know, I was up this morning.
We're doing double the amount of work.
Is that right? Tony Chow is in the control room. A special thanks to Tony and Joe Sykes and Ryan Nantel for helping out the last couple weeks while Galen and I were away.
Yes, thank you.
You can get in touch by emailing us podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show in general or about your redistricting questions. Let me shill for reviews here. Please leave us a rating or a review. It really helps when you leave us a rating.
On Jody's timeline, leave a review of his Twitter feed.
Not on my Twitter feed, in the Apple Podcast Store. It helps us go up in the rankings. When we go up in the rankings, lots of people who don't know about the show discover the show, and then we can be their trusty companion through the 2018 midterms.
Rank them.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.